Hello, it's Derek Arden, and again, and welcome to the Monday Night Chat Show. Today, I'm absolutely delighted to have Sally Kettle with me. Let me tell you a little bit about Sally. She's had an amazing career up to now, and I know that she's a very ambitious woman, and she'll be doing all sorts of other things. Sally was the first woman to row the Atlantic from east to west twice. How about that? Not once, back for more, and did it twice. And the other extraordinary thing is, the first time she did it, her boyfriend chickened out and decided not to go with her. I think that's probably fair, Sally. And
no, it's not, but we'll go.
Well, this is my introduction, so you get your return on me in a minute. That's fine. And then she took her mum with her. A mum? Can you believe that? And then the second time, she took four of her friends, or three of her friends and herself, and they hit a disaster and the worst weather in a 200 years in the Atlantic Ocean. So I've seen some of the pictures, and you're going to see them as well. So welcome, Sally. Thanks for joining us. Tell us a little bit about you. I know you live in Surrey. What are you doing at the moment?
Well, funny enough, in this COVID time, I've never been so busy. This is somebody who managed to get away with not having a proper job for the last 15 years. We all go into lockdown and everybody's going on furlough and losing their jobs. And suddenly, you know, I've landed myself one, which is quite incredible. I work for a mental health charity now, and I've set up my own charity, which is really exciting. So everything that I've done in the last 15 years has suddenly informed the work that I'm doing now. And it's really, really rather good. I'm really excited.
Well, congratulations, and thanks for sparing the time to join us. I know how busy you are, you were telling me just now. Now, I've got to ask you this. Why would anyone in their right mind want to row the Atlantic Ocean? Why would they want to do it twice?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it isn't the first thing that most people imagine themselves doing. But I had what I would call a quarter life crisis. So I was in my mid-20s. I'd just come out of a theatre degree, and I kind of was deciding, what the hell am I going to do with my life? And my boyfriend at the time, his name's Tomo, decided that he wanted to row across the Atlantic. And when he asked me if I wanted to do it, I was looking for something amazing to happen, almost like a rite of passage. And I decided that the time was right, and that is exactly what we needed to do, even though we had never rowed before in our lives or been at sea. It seemed like the obvious choice to me. So there you go.
Well, I'm not sure that we'll accept that explanation. It all sounds a bit crazy. So how did you go about doing it? I imagine you needed a huge amount of sponsorship.
Yeah, we did. So when I first phoned the ocean rowing kind of race organisers, because at the time, so ocean rowing was pretty much still in its infancy. The first ocean rowers were British, and they were John Ridgway and, what's his name? I can't remember his name. They rowed across, and say that again, Shea Blythe. Who said that? Yeah, Shea Blythe, right. Shea Blythe, they rowed across in 1966, and they were the first people to row across the Atlantic Ocean. And then it kind of trickled out that random, mainly British people, because, you know, we Brits do weird and wonderful things. If there's something bloody stupid to do, we do it, right? So they started trickling out doing individual rowing kind of exploits around the world. And in 1997, there was an ocean rowing race, which was very well publicised, because a lady called Deborah Searle went across, and she ended up doing it solo, having started with her husband. And my boyfriend at the time, Tomo, had heard about it, and that's why he knew that there were ocean rowing kind of regattas and races happening. So we called up the organisers and asked them what it involved, and they said it was going to be around £50,000 to £100,000 to get to the start of the race, which is a huge amount of money. But at the time, I don't know what it was. It was kind of like a combination of will, excitement, enthusiasm. It was just the perfect storm of the right place, the right people at the right time. And so when we decided we were definitely going to do it, it just seemed to snowball. And I can't tell you how that happened, but it just seemed to work. And that's one of the things that I've learned through that experience is that there are times when you're constantly banging your head against a brick wall, and maybe it's actually telling you something, because when things have really worked for me, they've pretty much worked from the outset. And even though they've been challenging and difficult, the walls haven't been so solid that you haven't been able to get through them. So I'm certainly experiencing that now with my new charity. It just seems to be kind of working. It really was an extraordinary time, and so incredible in terms of the number of people who wanted to support us and help us get across.
Brilliant. I think that's a really interesting learning point we might explore later about banging your head against the brick wall. Now, you've got some slides to show us.
Yeah, I have.
So let's take a look at those, and I'll ask you some questions as we go through it. So
here we go. So yeah, this would be kind of like my holding slide, all the different things. So I ended up being a professional adventurer after my ocean row, which is why I've put in a couple of photos at the bottom. I deployed to a disaster with a charity called Shelterbox, some of you may have heard of. So I did that after my rows. And I also sailed in the Clipper Round the World Yacht Race, which is why the sailing one is in there too. So and this is Tomo. You were going to say something. What were you going to say about him?
Well, I was just going to say he's got a nice smile.
When I do my talks, I say he's a man who needs to go to Specsavers.
but hang on, Tomo wanted to do this.
He did.
Then he changed his mind and bottled
out. No, he didn't. What happened was he had epilepsy. No, it's okay. It's a difficult one because I've kind of almost painted a picture of this super successful, everything's going right, we get in the boat and, you know, he decides he doesn't want to do it. Well, actually, it was slightly more challenging than that, in that people within the team were saying to me that Tomo probably wasn't going to be able to make it across. They could tell that he wasn't really 100% committed, but he was the one who'd come up with the idea and I'd committed to him, if that makes sense. So I kind of got on the boat with the knowledge that I knew that he would find it exceptionally difficult and would probably not make it across. But he also had epilepsy, and we were raising money for a charity called the Fund for Epilepsy, which was based in Halifax. And we promised to raise them £1 million, because obviously you do, right? It's not like we needed to raise £100,000 already. We set our sights really high. And funny enough, there is definitely a case for go big or go home. Sometimes making it, you know, a huge challenge and advertising it as being much bigger than you think you're capable of means that you surpass everything you are capable of. And that certainly worked for us. And people saw Tomo and I and gave us money because they thought we were going to die. So he ended up having a seizure 4 days in. And we had to sit for 2 days waiting for the support yacht to come and get us and take us back to La Gomera. And that's where we started. So in the Canary Islands, ocean rowing races tend to start from the Canary Islands, and La Gomera is the starting point now. So yeah, it's a picture for me that tells 1,000 stories, not for you guys necessarily, but when I look at his face, it's one of somebody who had so much passion to prove his condition wrong, but probably didn't know themselves well enough to be able to do it. And in fact, the Ocean Rowing Society's motto is know thyself. I would say that before I went, I probably didn't know myself that well, but I knew that I would absolutely not fail. And that was something, funny enough, that my mum and I shared. And I'll talk about my mum in a minute, but I knew I would not fail. It would have to be a massive disaster for me to not complete it. I certainly got to know myself by the end of it.
You told me when we had a rehearsal that this support boat is a sailing boat, and it supports all the rowers wherever they are, and they could be 10 days apart. I thought it would be a £1 million racing boat that would support you, but it's nothing like that. So this is much riskier than I assumed and other people would assume.
Yes, absolutely. You have to go with the mentality that you're on your own. If you go thinking you're going to be supported by your support, you're going to be very badly disappointed. Actually, the next slide is interesting because it kind of gives you an idea of how big the boat is. So, you know, if you are going out to sea on your own, and this is what you're going into the Atlantic in, you know, it's funny, I wouldn't have said that I was very courageous at the time, but looking back, I probably was pretty courageous to go in a boat this small, right? And what's interesting now, especially in the first lockdown, is that, you know, I went on this adventure knowing that I would be with one other person for up to 3 months in a boat only, you know, 8 meters long by 2 meters wide. And those people who've gone into lockdown, you know, in small flats with small children, you know, hadn't chosen that, but I'd chosen to do this and survived it. But anyway, so that's how big the boat is. And you can see at one end, there's the cabin in which you sleep, which is about the size of a two-man tent. You keep all your food in the hatches down the centre. And actually, let me show you this. This is after we came back. So we'd been picked up by the support yacht. They throwed us a line. And, you know, can you see the blue bit in the centre there, the top? Yeah. The boat got damaged, unfortunately, in the rescue. I'm not going to say rescue, actually, when we were picked up and brought back to Lagomoa, but you can see all the kit that we've got on the boat that needed to be taken off. And we left the boat with a boat builder to fix it. And we came back to the UK.
How much did that cost to fix? Took a lot.
You know what? You know, I can't remember. To be honest with you, money was just pouring out. Money was pouring out because, you know, we were anticipating that we'd be in a boat for 3 months. Suddenly we were back in La Gomera, having to rent a bloody hotel room again, having to fly ourselves home. So, you know, and get a boat builder. But we'd been so successful with our charity fundraising. We raised £268,000.
Fantastic.
So, you know, we didn't spend that money on all the logistics. We raised enough money for that too. But as a team, we were very successful. Yeah.
Okay.
There you go.
Let's see the next slide. I know there's some really good ones coming.
It's my mom. There she is. So, this is an interesting one because 6 months before I went with Tomo, I hadn't spoken to my mum for nearly 10 years. Wow. I left home at 16, pleased to go. My mum's a redhead. She was 60. She was also 16 when she had my brother, who's a year and a half older than me. She had three kids before she was 21. Okay. We had a very difficult relationship. And when I told her that I was going to row the Atlantic, I did it while she was driving the car so she wouldn't hit me. And she said, "Oh, you'll never make it across. You're too skinny. Tomo has epilepsy." But we'd already bought the boat, so I was definitely going. And I was telling my dad, who I get on really well with, about the adventure. And I said it was a bit like camping, but instead of hills and cows, it's waves and whales. And my mum likes a bit of camping. So I ended up telling her about it. And it seemed to be the right time to make amends for my mum and I. And I kind of felt that if there was an opportunity to take a step towards her, then this was it, because I didn't want to be in a situation where years down the line our relationship had was beyond repair. So weirdly, I kind of asked my mum if she would come with me, and she said yes, and I had 2 months to teach her how to row across the Atlantic.
Gee whiz, you two are a couple of determined women, aren't you?
We are.
That's awesome. And you said you had an abusive relationship with your mum, really, when you
So it's quite underplayed how damaging emotional abuse can be. And my mum could sometimes be physically abusive, but she was very emotionally abusive. And you knew if the Hoover was going that you were in the shit. So I lived in a household of fear for a long time, which has had its repercussions over the years. And it came back to haunt me, weirdly, when I had IVF for my daughter. And through therapy, I discovered I had post-traumatic stress. from the experiences with my mum, but also from the experiences of being with other women in authority. And there was a lot of that around IVF, because you meet a lot of doctors and lots of them are women in that situation. And what I thought I'd put to bed in my relationship with my mum actually kind of sprung up again. And that's because emotional abuse is so pervasive and can take a long time to heal. And I'm not sure if I'm really ever going to be over it, but I love my mum and I forgive my mum for what she put us through as children. And I am exceptionally proud of the fact that she and I achieved something remarkable. And for many people, especially doing talks over the last 15 years, the number of people who've came up and said, your talk has enabled me to kind of reassess my relationship with my own mother or my own family. I'm going to make an effort to go and see them or do something. And I think that's been one of the most valuable things that I've got from being a speaker.
Sally, that's absolutely brilliant. There's loads of learning points for people, especially as we go into the second lockdown on Thursday, with the amount of stress that will be around and the amount of people that perhaps some of us will be able to help. I hope we can. Sally, yeah. can we get down to this this extraordinary experience? This is the first time, is it? That's you and your mum.
Yeah, this is mum. This is 3 days before we left. And this was mum's first time in the boat. So needless to say, she didn't have a lot of experience. But in ocean rowing, they say that if you last the first 2 weeks, you'll make the whole way across. And you go south until the butter melts and turn right. So that was the plan. So this was my mum going out first time. You get an idea of the sense of the boat and the proportions of it. And this is me rowing. I mean, what can I say about rowing? It's rowing. And the funny thing is, when I do talks, I don't talk about rowing, because rowing is just this. It's rowing. It's boring. It's monotonous. Your backside kills you. Your hands become claws and they get covered in blisters. We had a pair of pants that told us which way the wind was blowing. I mean, this is it. That is rowing, and it's as exciting as I've explained it. It is a lesson in managing boredom. Really, it really is. And it took us 106 days to get across. That's
106 days. Wow.
How old are you? Can I ask how old you are, Derek?
Me? No, you can't. No, I never.
Go on.
Old. I'm really old, actually, Sally. But so that's.
No, well, you know what? Shall I tell you what? Okay, there was a guy in his 60s. Who rowed across a month quicker than we did, and he did it on his own.
Wow.
So there's still hope for you yet, that's what I'm saying.
Thank you very much. And I like that's the teddy bear on the front of the boat, actually.
Yeah, I know. That's, well, it's a lamb, and Sir Francis of Assisi, Saint Francis of Assisi, is the saint for epilepsy.
So it's not very rough, clearly it's not very rough.
Not on this trip. No, we went across. In fact, we had flat calms. We had so many flat calms that if you can imagine rowing a ton boat in a flat calm, it's just two of you. It's really pretty hardcore. Yeah. So that's why, one of the reasons why it took us so long. And also, my mum and I are built for comfort, not for speed. What can I say?
Is it the same as a sailing boat then? So if you can get the wind to blow you along a bit, it's better to go with the wind rather than go direct.
Yeah, absolutely. You go with the wind. Okay. And we call it the cone of success. And actually, funnily enough, that's another great learning point. And that is, at the beginning, you can waft around as much as you like in your cone. So it gets, you know, you can make lots of big errors. But as you get closer to your goal, you make smaller errors as you get in. So, you know, don't worry about making lots of mistakes at the start. Just hone it as you get closer to the end. Anyway, so that's rowing, and that's me and my mum when we got to the end. In Barbados, of all places. And I was telling you earlier, wasn't I, about the yacht at the back, either owned or rented by Ian Botham. Yep. And I met him then, and I met him a couple of years later at a charity gig, and he goes, oh, you look much better now. And I said, oh, thanks a lot. Thanks for that. Yeah, so that was us. And the weirdest thing was the muscles in your legs atrophy, so they go very wobbly. And we got off the boat, and it was, I think it's a little bit, it was a kind of an anxiety. And I think people are going to be feeling this actually after this, you know, I'm certainly feeling it now, weirdly, an anxiety of returning to normal life. You know, so I was literally talking to a friend earlier today about how I hadn't been into London, I haven't been on a train since March. And there's a part of me that feels a little bit kind of nervous about it, which seems so stupid. And the same thing happened here when I was on the rowing boat, is that when you're there, life is so simple. You You get up, you row, you eat, you drink, you sleep. That's it. There's no worries about bills. There's no worries about life. You know, you think about life a lot, but you know, you can't do anything about it. You're definitely in a present moment. And you come back and you suddenly have to be back in real life again. And that can be quite frightening. And it felt quite frightening. To the point
where... I have questions for you. Presumably you row all through the night. This is 24-hour rowing, is it?
Well, yes and no. So if you want to go across quickly, then you do 24 hours a day. But Mum and I found the night shift was so demoralising that we ended up sleeping during the night together. And sometimes we drifted further during the night than we rowed during the day. Who knew?
Okay, I get that, yeah. Isn't it dangerous though, one of you not being on on watch?
So there are kind of two significant motorways for shipping, and that's down the side of Africa and then up the side of the Americas, and that's where you see most of the big tankers. In the middle you hardly see anything at all, but you have what we call the STRESSME, which is a SEAMI, which is a radar reflector, and it beeps, and it's stressful because you're literally lying there with one eye open and you see it flashing. And if it flashes really fast, you're out on deck talking to somebody. And we did talk to a very nice Frenchman, and we'd been out for about 2 months at that point. And I was kind of, oh my God, men, right? On the blower to the French guy, trying to explain to him that we had a parachute anchor. And the parachute anchor is a big 12-foot parachute on a 100-meter line. I'm mixing my metrics here, but and it floats in the water. And he thought we actually had an anchor that we throw over the side of the boat. and it's like 7 miles deep in the Atlantic. So we must have had a 7-mile chain.
Wow.
But that's what he thought we had. Yeah.
Okay, so that's with your mum. Now, what about the second trip? You've got a couple of pictures on the second trip.
I have. Right. So I came back, dumped Tomo, not because he failed on the row, but because actually he was just a bit of an arsehole. But
the recording's still running. Do you want me to delete that bit?
No, you know what? You know when you just... He used to use me as a bit of a foil. So he would totally take the piss out of me in front of his friends all the time and demean me. And I realised on that row that I'd achieved something so remarkable that actually it gave me the confidence to realise that I didn't need him in my life, and I didn't need to have people who made me feel bad about myself in my life. So I got rid of him, and I was really pleased to do that. Anyway, so I decided I wanted to do it again. Yeah,
so you persuaded another three head cases
to come on
a rowing boat with you.
Yeah, I did. And the reason was because I wanted a world record. I wanted to be a big fish in a big pond. There'd never been a women's four before. And so I skippered a women's four. And we'd been told by the race organisers, the next race, it was a year and a half later, that we were going to be the only women's four taking part in the race. But then when we got to the start in La Gomera, another women's four turned up, and they were from Guernsey, and they called themselves Mission Atlantic, but we renamed them the Guernsey Milkers. And they were the only team that we wanted to beat. But we didn't know that we were going into the worst weather in that particular part of the Atlantic for nearly 200 years. And we were hit by the tail end of a hurricane and two tropical storms. And we faced weather like this. And this is a good day. So we came down 40-foot waves and had 60-knot winds. You can see how fast the wind's blowing on that particular day. Yeah. And this was after the reason why we had the support yacht come get us. Well, come take this photograph was because Jo, one of the girls on the boat, actually I might go back and point her out so you can eyeball her, is the girl with the kind of the golden sunglasses. So, you know, slipped, she hurt her back, and she stopped rowing and started whinging. And anybody who works in teams will know that you don't need a whinger on the team, right? She decided she wanted to get off the boat, and in doing so, she would disqualify us from the race. And the support yacht came on this occasion to come and pick her up, and she changed her mind and said, I'm not going. So they went off across the horizon. Of course, as soon as they did that, guess what she did? She changed her mind. She wanted to get off.
Wow.
So they said they couldn't come back for another 10 days because out of the 26 boats in that race that year, 16 capsized and 9 didn't self-right.
So, 16 capsized. Hang on a minute. That's quite easy to capsize that boat. I'm just looking carefully at that slide, isn't it? I mean, it only looks like about 2 foot between the water and the side of the boat.
Yeah, but you must, because you're so old, Derek. You really are. You must remember Weebles. Do you remember Weebles?
No,
so I've got nodding. Who's that? Who's nodding? I can't see your name, but
that'll be John Lisby. Yeah. He's about 20 years older than me.
So Weebles were kind of like little toys that have really heavy bottoms. So when you knock them, they don't fall over.
I remember those.
Yeah. Exactly. This is exactly the same principle. So what you do is you have emergency fresh water ballast down the spine of the hull of your boat. And what it does is it serves as a weeble. So when you go over, it should self-right. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that many of the crews, because it's so hot in that part of the Atlantic, because you're down by the Tropic of Cancer, it's very hot. So you leave your cabin doors open. And even if it's just a jar, and it means that if you go over, you flood and you can't self-right it.
Wow.
So, scary stuff. And two girls were on their upturned hull for 16 hours waiting to be rescued, which was pretty scary for them. So she wasn't a priority, but they eventually did come back and pick her up, and they sent her rubber dinghy.
Presumably people die doing this, do they?
Not often. I think in the last, in modern ocean rowing history, only 3 people have died.
Okay. Well, it looks
one went overboard and they never recovered him. And I think actually most of the time
We don't need the details on that, Sally. I think we need to hear about your success here. So
So she got off, she disqualified us from the race, left 3 of us on the boat. We were attacked by a shark. A few days later, we'd lost our rudder. A huge rippling wave came and actually sheared the rudder off the back of our boat. We had a line of t-shirts and a water bottle, and a shark decided he wanted to eat it, and he did. We were all hiding in the cabin screaming like girls, right? And as the skipper, this is a lesson to be learned, isn't it? As a skipper, I nominated one of the crew to go out and go and cut the lines to the back of the boat. So poor Sue was flung out the door of the cabin and she cut the line. We didn't have a rudder for the next 1,000 miles and we still managed to row into the end, into Antigua. Third from last. Yeah, that was interesting.
So, don't do what I say, don't do what I do, do what I say then, from your leadership style.
Well, exactly. Actually, it's funny because I do a lot of talks for girl guiding. I'm an ambassador for girl guides. And I always say, guess what? If there's something really dangerous, make sure you nominate somebody else to do it. And they find it really funny.
I'm not sure that's the right answer, isn't it? Is it?
It's not.
I'm just going to ask people to put their questions in the chat box because we're almost coming to the end of the first part of this this interview. I think when we get you back in January, we'll ask you a few leadership questions as well, because I know there's a lot of things to learn from that. Are you still friends with Jo, the woman that jumped off the boat?
Yes, I am. And I'm actually friends with her and not with the two girls who stayed on board. And I think the reason why is because I realised, and it took a long time to learn this lesson, that sometimes you fail. And in failing, you are not a failure. And she was brave enough to give it another go. And that's exactly what she did. And she got in a boat with the two girls, you know, from the upturned hull. And another woman in the same race whose boat was also capsized. And they rowed across in the fastest time for a women's four, and they got the world record. It's sometimes not what you do, but what you inspire other people to
do. Yeah,
do
that's a bit different. Right? You're just going to show us the trophy, are you, behind you?
This is my trophy. So I kind of said, I went to the world record. And a year or two after the second row, my mum and I found out that we made it into the Guinness Book of Records as the first mother and daughter to row any ocean. And because it's a first, it can't be beaten.
Ta-da. Fantastic. Congratulations from all of them. Absolutely, absolutely brilliant. And this is Sally's final slide where everyone can get in touch with her, email her for a book, and also if you know anyone that needs a fantastic speaker, please recommend her. So that would be great. Three or four things, Sally, and you will come back and talk to us again anyway, and we'll fire a few questions at you. You come up with a lot of leadership and management points there, which are absolutely fantastic. I mean, talking about negativity, people telling us we'll never do anything. I work with one or two charities where people need a lot of support, and, you know, they believe people when they tell them you won't do it, which is awful, isn't it? And how many people have stopped doing things because someone they looked up to said they would never do it? That was the first thing. One or two of us are into NLP. For people that aren't into NLP, Sally moves her eyes in some very interesting directions when she's picturing what happened in that rowing boat. Up left is recalling the future, recalling the past, if you're at like 80% of the people. And this is also a good way of telling if someone's not telling you the truth. The police usually not, because you would look the opposite way. That's something for another day. How much did you actually raise? You said it cost about £100,000, didn't it?
And on top of that, we raised £268,000. So what's interesting about that is that we set ourselves the goal of £1 million, but actually, you know, we reassessed and thought, if we set ourselves £20,000, we would have raised £20,000.
Yeah.
The fact that we set ourselves such a huge goal, we ended up reaching a huge goal. And in the second one, we raised £30,000 for Shelterbox, who at the time wasn't looking for money because they do disaster relief. And the tsunami had only been about a year before that. So they were rolling in cash, but they hadn't got any, people didn't know about them. So I made a promise to them that I would talk about Shelterbox and promote them, and also qualify as one of their response team, which is exactly what I did. And I deployed to two disasters, which were an eye-opener.
Brilliant. Well, we'll come back to that next time. Now we've got some questions in the box. Amy wants to know where you slept, and also, would you do it again?
The first question is easy. It's in that cabin. So like I said, it's about the size of a two-man tent. And when you're all in it, you can actually get four girls in there. It's a bit of a squash, and we didn't do it regularly. So we tended to do two in, two on, and swap round. And then when Joe got off the boat, this was a lesson I should have learned, is that I separated myself and I put myself in the front cabin to give the two other girls space to sleep. And that isolated me completely from the other girls. And then I started to become paranoid because so much had gone wrong. And I think this is what leaders tend to do a lot, is they separate themselves from their workforce, and then they become paranoid because they're not sure what they're talking about, and they think they're talking about them. And really what we should have done is mix and match and kind of taken it in turns to be in each other's cabins. So that, you know, that kind of...
That's a really interesting point, yeah.
Yeah. It really didn't benefit me at all to be away from the crew. That was really hard. And would I do it again? Never say never.
It looked like a no to me from your
point of view. It kind of is a no, yeah. You know, I've been there, done that. And I tried to row around Great Britain a few years after, and that was really tough. But I realised as soon as I was in the boat at Tower Bridge, I thought, oh my God, I missed this. But when we were rescued at Margate, I realised I really hadn't missed it. So that was an interesting experience.
Yeah, and I know exactly how far Margate is from London.
It's not far.
Yeah, no, that's great. I think it's a really interesting point you make about goal setting, because most people get goal setting wrong. They set goals that are easily attainable rather than a ridiculous goal that you'll never get to. And then you achieve a lot more than you would have done if you just set. And that's the same with targets in business, I think, as well. But that's also for another day. Now here's sit back, because Duncan's now asking you, what were the three biggest learnings?
Yeah, well, it's one thing I haven't mentioned is my mum and I's mantra of no hope on the boat. So at one point we were going the wrong way. I was whinging a lot and I was saying, oh, I hope it gets better. I hope the wind gets better. I hope the rain gets better. And my mum hit me in the face with a wet flying fish. And she said, stop hoping all the time. And she explained it to me and it made perfect sense in that when one hopes in that way, you're expecting something or somebody to intervene, or something or somebody to make a difference, when actually you are in this situation, you need to see exactly how it is and deal with it as it presents itself. So I call myself a positive pragmatist and somebody who is hopeless in all the right ways, meaning in all my right ways anyway. And that is, I don't hope for the future. I accept the present as it is and work towards, stuff in a positive way. And people find that really difficult. So that was one of them. The next one is that you're way more resilient than you realise. but many of us don't have the opportunity to test it. And the last kind of biggest learning points, I suppose, for me was forgiveness. Forgiveness and kindness. My mum taught me kindness on the boat and Joe taught me forgiveness.
Brilliant, fantastic. Okay, John wants to know if you'd led a team before.
No, so that was interesting. That was really, really interesting. And I found it incredibly hard. And I learned a lot about the way female teams work, actually. Everybody had told us that it would be a catfight, everybody would be bitching, it would be awful. There was a lot of negativity around it. And actually, we worked incredibly well. And even when things went wrong, we treated other with respect. But it tends to be a democracy, and democracies often don't work. Somebody has to take a decision, and I found that very difficult to do. I don't find that as difficult to do nowadays. Sometimes you've got to be a benign dictator.
yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah. And John also wants to know whether you should have had a camera on board and it would have been a better program than
Big Four. Yeah, I know. Well, you know what? Funny enough, since the Rose, I've been banging on the drum for being seeing more female adventurers on the television. And I pitched a lot to do that. And I had an agent to be a presenter, and it never happened. And, you know, I can beat myself up and say it just wasn't because they didn't like me. But actually what it is that they still haven't chosen a female adventurer to go on the TV, you know, of the caliber of Bear Grylls and the like. I don't know why that is. I can guess. In fact, I did go to talk to a commissioner event, and the woman who was representing Discovery at that time, which was about five or six years ago, said, women don't watch women and men don't watch women. We'll never have a female adventurer on Discovery Channel.
So they wonder, yeah. So this is all about what sells TV programs and sells adverts, then, really, and the business case for the cost.
Yeah, and it's changing. It's changing, but I decided this year that I wasn't going to pursue that TV presenting goal anymore. I knew that I wasn't that adventurer anymore, and actually, to let it go has made me feel so much better. Because I'd been banging the drum for a long time, beat myself up about it for a long time, always felt that I was so close to achieving something in that field. And now I don't want it anymore. And it's okay not to want it and to just let it go. Mm. I call it letting go of the ferret, because if you try and hold on to any small animal too hard, they end up biting you, the little buggers. So I had to let go of that ferret.
Sally, that's absolutely fantastic. Thanks so much for joining us. Will you stay on and answer a few questions once the recording's finished? For anybody watching this on YouTube, listening to this on the Negotiators podcast, Sally's book's available from Sally. What's the email address to email you, Sally?
Sally@sallykettle.com.
Sally@sallykettle.com. That's not That's very easy to remember. Fantastic. Thanks very much, Sally, for joining us. Absolutely brilliant. And we look forward to you joining us in the new year. That's Sally Kettle.